Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation Economic Development and Speaker's Subcommittee. We opened as a subcommittee. And at this time, we're going to ask Deborah Lincoln to come back up, and we're going to talk about answers to questions, and hopefully we'll have a few of our members dropping in.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Employment Department. And you have in front of you a packet that you can put into your, Representative Krieger is already doing, into your notebooks, that responds to some of the questions, or most of the questions, I think you got most of them, that you asked us yesterday. I'll go through these real quickly. On page 3 of 14, behind the letter, you asked about the partners that we work with to deliver workforce services. These are the partners that are the programs, actually, that are listed in the Federal Workforce Investment Act and those partners that provide those programs, both at the state and local level. You'll notice we work with a lot of Department of Human Services agencies, community colleges, and the local Title I-B providers, or what we call them, workforce providers. Senator Carter out of the room, I'll call them the former JTPA group. Page 4 of 14, I believe Senator Morse asked us how much other states spend on employment services program. We put in the chart that we worked off yesterday with the amount of money under the, each state's name. We're at 28.3. California, of course, is the most with $122.5 million. The third question, we spent some time on the phone with both Department of Corrections and OYA yesterday, as well as our field staff, pulling together information about who does what with corrections. And what we've got is some anecdotal information, as well as the chart that you see in front of you comes from the Department of Corrections, Community Corrections Employment Services Survey. And as you know, when people are let out of the state system, they are part of a county parolee operation. So each of the counties that deals with parolees is there. And you see what it is they do with their clients as they get out and are beginning to look for jobs and get back into life. We do a lot with kiosks. A lot of kiosks in the correctional institutions. Many inmates are required to work on the kiosk to identify job possibilities before they're released. One issue that comes up, of course, is that a lot of the inmates, as they're released, are not job ready, and so they go into some kind of training or life skills training, as we discussed yesterday, before they come to the employment department. So the one-stops are very much involved as well in the community colleges with those clients. The next couple of pages.
Mr. Chair, just for a second. At the bottom of that page, 4 of 14, Class of County Lives in Transition, and this is mentor helps identify. Who are the mentors? Those volunteers or those agency people, county people?
My assumption is that they're agency people and county people, but I don't know for sure. I'll have to find that out for you. We've got descriptions of some of the programs that we've got with various institutions. Powder River does quite a bit in their pre-release, their transition program for inmates. In Pendleton, EOCI works in a STEPS program that again, works on transition, how to write a resume, how to look for a job, kinds of things. And some of our offices, again, are working with county jails to help those folks as they transition back into the main population.
Debbie, were you able to find out how many of the state prison operations, correction facilities are actually doing this sort of operation as far as preparing them for release? Look at the job.
All of them do something. It's hard for us to say, and I think hard for them to say right now, given the budget cuts.
Right.
I know that we were talking last week about the GED and ESL programs being cut back in a major way, particularly here in Salem. So at this point, I'm not sure what they're going to be able to carry forward, but all of them have done pre-release programs and have connected with both us, mostly health human service types programs, as people are coming out. How much that will carry forward, I don't know. Question four, Senator Dukes asked us to develop a performance measure that relates to structural unemployment.
Page number?
Page 9 of 14. We will, actually, we're not ready to bring that back yet, but we'll talk to, I know the people we've been working with and the former AFS division, Children and Adults and Children and Families, I think it's called now, are working with some of those folks, and we're going to work with them to pin down the definition of structurally unemployed so we can really get at those folks and work on a performance measure to see how we can measure that, the work with those folks. Question five, again on nine, the benchmarks are written out so that you have a little bit better understanding of what it is we're actually contributing to. Employment dispersion we talked about yesterday, net job growth and so forth.
Maybe while you're doing that, I'm going to go ahead and close the subcommittee and open this for regular full committee. Is it appropriate to say full committee when we're a subcommittee?
Yes, subcommittee.
Full subcommittee.
Only got one of those,
Wendy.
Got two.
Oh.
Full luck would have it.
On page 10, I think Senator Morris asked about the trust fund accounts of those states we were comparing ourselves to. And we've listed those there, California obviously being the biggest one. And he also asked about accounts receivable age analysis. You've got here on the bottom of page 10 an aging for our unemployment insurance benefit overpayment accounts. And most of them are in the first 24 months. We're working to collect those. On the top of page 11,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Morris.
There's some things that really jump out at me.
I'm going to call my expert up here.
Well, I can't let this one pass without
I thought you probably
asking for a little more detail. If those are days that we were measuring to, but they're months we're measuring
to. Months.
So I guess my question would be, what are we doing to accelerate those payments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, for the record, it's Tom Byerly, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance. Things we're looking at are ways to incent people to pay us back. One of the things we did just recently, in fact, the 1st of December, was allow individuals for the first time to use a Visa or MasterCard to pay us back. So we're hoping that gains us a lot. In the first 2 weeks, we got $25,000, which felt pretty good since we hadn't advertised it yet. Other things we're doing are we continue to intercept state tax refunds when they become available to pay money back. We, in 1997, we obtained the ability from the legislature to charge interest on these overpayments, whereas before we didn't have that ability. That's another incentive to pay us back. And with that interest money, we've been allowed to buy or pay for additional revenue agents that do the collection of these accounts. We're calling them more now than we used to. In the past, we simply sent them a bill and hoped that they would pay because we had so many to contact. Now we're actually calling them individually and setting up payment plans. We also have the ability to garnish wages when they do return to work to help pay this money back. Those are tools we just obtained in the last two bienniums. And we're just now getting on a roll. We have dropped the receivables from a high of $33 million in the year 2000 down to what you see today. So I think we're making a pretty good dent in what we've got going.
Tom, are the agents that are going out, are these private contractors, collection agencies, or are these actually state employees?
The agents I just referred to are state employees, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. We do use private collection agencies after a period of about 18 months if we're not successful in collecting.
We
haven't gotten good results from that, I might add, but we do send them over to them.
Do you have authority, because we found this out on collecting back student loans a few years ago, and I think it was 97, that if you could go in and make a deal with them, you know, get a commitment to payment, do you have the authority to do that, to actually reduce the amount to make sure that some sort of payment is made?
We don't have the authority under statute to reduce the amount paid because it does go back to the UI Trust Fund.
Right.
We can waive the interest if that incents them to pay.
And overpayment, is that something that a recipient is likely to realize when they get it? I mean, or is this like the first one you get has an overpayment and then you get two or three more with the same amount so you wouldn't know the difference? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, an overpayment of benefits can result from for several reasons. The main one that we combat are people that work and don't correctly report their earnings while they're on unemployment insurance benefits. Sometimes it's even fraudulent. There are times also during the appeal process, let's say we determined that the job separation, the claimant was not at fault, we allowed benefits, the employer has a right to appeal. Under appeal, the employer prevails, so that can create an overpayment. We notify the claimants, and then we ask them to repay.
Okay.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, I believe had made the comment that the outsourcing for collection was not very effective, that you didn't implement it until after 18 months. Is this something new that you've started, or is it something that's been ongoing so you do have, in fact, a track record? My experience in the private sector is if you wait 18 months, a year and a half, to try to collect something, it really is an uphill battle. But if you get on it very quickly and start working the accounts, your success rate just goes up tremendously.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I hope I didn't make or lead you to believe that we just let accounts sit for 18 months before we send them out, because that's not the case. What happens is we make every attempt we can to collect. In fact, our revenue agents have resources that the private collection agencies simply don't have, because we have access to wage records from not only our state, but other state, all other 53 jurisdictions. And by law, the private collection agencies cannot have access to those wage records, which helps us track and then garnish. The U.S. Department of Labor requires us to determine that the account is uncollectible before we can send it to a private collection agency. So that's a requirement we're up against. We review each account as closely as we can, and within a year, we are normally thinking about sending it to a private collection agency. So between a year and 18 months is when we send those over, and it's because we have been unsuccessful by federal guidelines.
So it's a federal law that prohibits you from outsourcing the collection?
Until it's uncollectible, that's correct.
As a follow-up to Senator Marsh's question, when a garnishment occurs, is a lien filed when possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that is correct. We do file liens if we can. The garnishments are very successful, however, so but we do have we do file the liens, yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do have a package, and a policy option package, one of our three, for to use fraud collections to increase our collection staff by three, and we anticipate how much additional to come in? $1 million?
$1 million, yeah.
Okay.
For revenue agents,
$2 million. $2 million, that's correct.
Now, a person would come in to sign up for services, are they alerted to the fact that make sure you don't abuse the system, that there are in fact penalties and collection mechanisms in place?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We give everybody that files an unemployment insurance claim a services handbook, and there are several areas throughout the handbook that talks about reporting to us correctly and things that might happen that might make you ineligible as a caution. We also have warnings. When you call in your claim for unemployment insurance benefits on the weekly system, it's an interactive voice response system, there are warnings in that system. We also use the state new hire directory where employers report new hires. We have that programmed into our system, so we tell the claimant when they call in their weekly claim, oh, by the way, we understand you've returned to work. Please don't forget to tell us about your earnings. And that's helped us prevent overpayments in the last couple of years. We hope to get, by the way, we hope to get access to the national new hire directory soon once Congress passes that action, so we can do that nationally.
The top of page 11, we have a breakdown of taxes owed. A couple of years ago, the Secretary of State took a look at this, said we probably wouldn't need to age these. We can on an ad hoc basis, and we're going to begin doing that on a quarterly basis. But at this point, we don't have an aging schedule for the taxes owed. Question 8 on that page, employer timeliness. Tom, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I checked with staff when I returned to the office yesterday to ask if there was any information we had with respect to why these reports may not be as timely as we'd like. And we don't have any real specific information. They did tell me that historically the first quarter is often the one that's the untimely. We speculate it's because other things are going on, like their federal and state income tax returns are due, so this might get put on the back burner. We don't have any real specific, just a wide variety of reasons that reports come up untimely. We do assist employers in filling them out or give them help over the phone or even send them reports that are they're almost complete so they can put in the numbers, but we don't have any specific information.
Senator Carter asked about military claims included in our statistics. Yes, military claims are included in the state where the claimant files his or her claim, but the federal government pays those states for the unemployment claims themselves, so it doesn't affect our trust fund balance. Duplication between services provided by the workforce analysts and the small business development centers. What we came up with, and as we looked at it a little more closely and talked to workforce analysts, they really work together. The small business development centers do an awful lot of training and so forth with businesses, how to do business plans and those kinds of things. We share information about businesses who need help. Our workforce analysts are in touch with businesses and can refer them to the SBDCs. So there's not duplication, but a very close working relationship with the SBDCs. There's quite a bit of anecdotal information there for you.
Mr. Chair. The thing that prompted my question yesterday was most specifically where we're writing job descriptions for companies. And it seemed to me that that would be something that the Small Business Development Center would logically do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think you're right. I think what we do is whoever is able to do it and gets, you know, is has the resources and works more closely with the company, it's going to help them do whatever they need to do. And I know particularly in Tillamook County and Washington Columbia counties there, we asked specifically about that. And the two work closely together so that they're not doing the same thing, but they've got enough resources so that the companies have access to somebody to help them. And it's a working back and forth kind of a thing.
And that's good, but can it be confusing to companies?
We try, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, we're trying real hard to let all this be transparent to companies. Somebody's there to help them. They don't care who, where that person's from or what organization it represents. As long as they have it's a no wrong door approach. As long as they have the ability to find somebody to help them, we try to take away that confusion and just, you know, they can call the SPDC, they can call us. Somebody's going to help them without saying, no, you really ought to be going to the SPDC for this particular situation. So that's the effort we're trying is to reduce that confusion. We were asked, bottom of page 12 here, we were asked to compare our efforts with some of the commercial, particularly the online job databases. It's very, we don't have real comparisons in terms of, you know, what the staffing agencies do, what all the resources on the web do, but we did find it interesting that Monster.com and Yahoo listed significantly less Oregon jobs than we have in our job database. Page 13, question 12, how many parolees are employed within two quarters? We don't track those parolees systematically. A lot of them are self-identified, so if somebody walks into our office and we don't know that person's a parolee or we haven't had contact with the parole officer, we wouldn't know that. But we do have some numbers out of our job search system that shows up there. When we talked to both OIA and the Department of Corrections yesterday, they're very interested in our PRISM tracking system, which is the next generation of our shared information system. They want to be part of that so that they can get their clients, their former customers, into our system and can track them as they move into the workforce again, and that system, which is currently in front of there's a substantive legislation currently in front of the Senate Consumer Business Labor Committee, will be able to do that.
Thank you, Chair George. I believe that question you're addressing was the question I asked yesterday. I appreciate you bringing that back. I guess the concern I probably should have been a little clearer. I guess the concern I have is, I understand tracking is a vital component of seeing how or ensuring that we employ ex-convicts. But I guess I was more interested in knowing what partnership could be developed to ensure that as folks are preparing to come out of this system, that employment opportunities are in place for them. Because I think that's where the ball's being dropped is a lot of folks have served their time. Obviously, because they've been incarcerated, they probably have lost their job. And many of those folks don't have the ability to find work without some assistance. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was hoping that we could talk a little bit more about the partnership that could be developed between the Employment Department and OIA or the Employment Department and Department of Corrections to ensure that we're exercising great initiative to find employment for these folks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, we do have, I don't know if you were in the room when we talked about this, on pages 5 through 9, we've got some, we've got quite a few descriptions of what transition programs are in place, particularly on page, let's see.
It's in here.
Yeah, in that hand out there, I'm sorry. I gave you a new one today just to confuse you. Particularly on page 5, the Powder River Correctional Facility is an example of the kinds of transition programs that the correctional facilities provide that we work with them as well as some of the other human services agencies work with them to be sure that as they leave the facility, there's
there's something there for them, if at all possible.
I had a meeting yesterday with the new department head of the DOC and head of OIA, and I also put in a placeholder bill, and I'm going to sponsor them. That's the committee decided they want to do something about it, so that hopefully we can access the federal funds that comes through our state through DOC, through workforce systems that would help with the adult population in terms of jobs as well as youth. And they were all excited about it. So we're going to get together with community college and make some plans to see how we can tighten the system up in the manner which we had a very fervent discussion yesterday. And also, there's a bill coming through with Workforce Inc. and community colleges in terms of work opportunities, not even a part of the bill. I'm hoping that that bill comes to this committee, because somewhere along the line, to have federal funds with an agency, with a system, let me say, like that, who's not talking to the largest driver of economic opportunity in terms of jobs in the state, community colleges, is incomprehensible to me. And so I think that that's where the system needs to be tightened up, so that everybody is talking to everybody. And so I'm going to be working with those people. If anybody else is interested, I'm more than willing for that to happen.
Yeah. Make sure you coordinate on particularly the valuable resource like community college. That's okay. Kind of startling yesterday,
exactly.
Talking to our friend on the floor.
Exactly. Yeah.
Representative Hanson.
Well, I'd just like to thank you for all the work that you must have done all night to get this. It always amazes me how we casually ask the questions during the meetings and all of the local employment department office survey. I mean, that... Yep. That must have taken a great deal of work, and I really appreciate it. I'm not going to get into the questions that this generates, because I don't want somebody having to put on a graveyard shift to answer them. But in digesting these, it gives us a lot of information in terms of how to better craft these types of partnerships. And clearly, you're taking that prison population seriously, and there's a lot of activity that's going on. The question is there a better way to focus it, particularly in terms of a way to increase your involvement because of your funding stream, take some pressure off of the local government and general fund office. But that's a conversation that could take place over the next few weeks.
Glad to have that. Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, just real quickly, we've had a couple of programs that we don't have anymore. One was, as Jan mentioned yesterday, with incarcerated vets. We had a model national program to get them, as they came out, into jobs. It was a competitive grant, and we didn't get the grant this last time, even though we were the model. They said that they wanted to share the wealth around the country. So we've got some real good models that we haven't been able to do for the last couple of years, but we'd be happy to dust off and try to bring it back.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions, essentially, but they're kind of broadly, I think, lumped together, kind of policy-type issues. If you go back to question number two, how much do other states spend on employment services programs, it appears that we're a bit of an anomaly with respect to the numbers of people in our workforce compared to Washington, certainly California being, must be three times.
Yeah, they're 10 times our population.
10 times?
Mm-hmm.
10 times, and Arizona, it appears that we're dedicating many more resources to this activity than the other states. And then the kind of the corollary question with respect to question number six, Employment Insurance Trust Fund, we appear to be an anomaly again with respect to Washington and California. And I'm wondering if we are exercising too much abundance of caution with respect to that fund. Now, you're measuring it first quarter of 2002, so essentially almost 12 months behind. And I don't know where those funds stand now. But just on a comparative basis in workforce population, we are very, very conservative, it would appear. And so I raise that issue. It could have a substantial impact on employers if there was a little rate relief to bring it into a little more of a line that is more in line with, I guess, other states. Now, I'm not suggesting we abandon our discipline. Mm-hmm. That would be the last thing that we should do. But I'm just wondering if we're over cautious with respect to this.
Consultancy. Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to talk about the trust fund. I think it's real important to understand how the whole thing works. If you'd like to do that now, we'd be glad to do it.
We can do that now. Okay. Thanks for this response. It really is a
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While Satish is passing that out, I'll just say one couple last things. Senator Carter, I think, asked about who's on the board of the Portland Region 2 Workforce Systems, Inc., and that's the loose piece you've got in front of you here. And you also asked me to draft a letter about the underfunding of the whole system for the delegation. The president's budget came out just yesterday. We're analyzing that for its impact on Oregon. And once we understand what that impact is, we'll draft a letter and bring that back to see if you're still interested in signing that. What you have in front of you now, the geocard thing, is a description of how the tax system works. And first of all, I'd like to take you to the back page, this diagram, and start very simplistically. There are two taxes, the federal unemployment tax and the state unemployment tax. The federal tax is set by the federal government, covers the first 7,000 of wages. It's actually 6.2% on those $7,000 of wages. If we are not in conformity, we pay, our employers pay the whole 6.2%. As long as we're in conformity with the federal requirements for unemployment and employment services, there's a significant federal tax offset, and it goes down to 0.8%. The state trust fund, you can see the rates there, and we'll talk a little bit more about how those are set on the first $25,000. Now, if you go up to the dollar sign, the employer payroll contributions, follow the solid black line to the state trust fund, the state taxes on the first $25,000, $26,000 now this year, are what pays for UI benefits. They go into a trust fund in the federal treasury that's dedicated only to Oregon, and that's what Senator Morse is asking about, I think. We'll talk about in a minute about how we keep that solvent. The federal taxes are the funds that we use to administer the program. They go up into a federal trust fund and come back to the states based on an allocation formula that the Fed Department of Labor manages to administer programs and services out of the Employment Department. That's the money, one of the ways we judge how useful that is by looking at how much we get back in administrative money compared to what our employers have paid in, and combined with all of the taxes our employers pay in, again, we get about 70 cents on the dollar back, which is more than a lot of states get back. In addition to that, and this goes back to the second question about the how we fund employment services, business and the legislature in the early 90s were distressed at how the federal government was underfunding employment services, job search services, and again, it's been flat for over 10 years. So the decision was to divert some of that money. And you'll see that one-time diversion line there. What happened is that we took about $280 million and put it in a pot called the Benefit Reserve Fund. That $280 million is only available to pay UI benefits. So the purpose of the principal is the same as it would have been had it gone on up to the Treasury. But the interest on that is available then for the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund. And that interest was dedicated by the legislature with the support of both business and labor to supporting employment services, job search services, and the administration of the department and the programs we provide.
And would you tell the committee that there's an advisory board of business people?
Yes.
Who guides you, advise you?
We do. We have an advisory board. It's four business people, four labor people, and four public people who oversee this whole thing with us and advise us on programs, policy, and our funding sources. Now, the trust, okay, so that's the administrative portion of it and how we support our programs and services. The federal unemployment tax account then, or excuse me, the state account then is what we pay benefits out of. And if you'll go to the middle, open the thing up, you'll see that on the left side, you'll see the graph that shows the trust fund balance. What we do is tag the line where we want to be based on, let me be sure I get this right, what it would take us to get through a recession, the strength of the recession of the 1970s. So not the worst one, not the 1980s recession, not the lightest one, which was the 1990s, but the 1970s recession. As you can see, in good times, the money available goes up above that line. In bad times, it can dip below. If it dips too far below, we've busted the trust fund, and we have to borrow from the federal government and repay with interest, which, again, is what Texas, New York, Illinois did during this recession. The way we keep that in balance is demonstrated on the left page, the unemployment insurance tax rate schedule. This is all set in statute, and it's a self-adjusting thing. Once, as the amount of money goes up above the line, the benchmark line, we drop into a lower tax schedule. If it drops down below the benchmark line, we go into a higher tax schedule. And you can see the years in the bubbles are the years we were in each individual tax schedule. The greatest tax schedule at 3.10% shows our trying to pull out of the recession of the early 80s. The lower tax schedules is where we have been through the decade of the 90s, where we were doing pretty well. We're currently in the fourth tax schedule, which is the balanced tax schedule. What basically comes in goes out. And again, that's adjusted based on what is actually in the trust fund, and it's not an administrative thing. It's an automatic thing. This is something, again, the advisory committee, business and labor, have supported over the years because it gives employers some surety of how much they're going to pay and where they go. Within each of those tax schedules is a range of taxes based on a particular company's rating experience. So I think the 1.75 in tax schedule 2, for example, is an average for each schedule. Somebody may be a little over, somebody may be a little under that, depending on the rating. So that's how we come up with tax rates and what actually goes into the trust fund and how we attempt to balance that out so that we don't have to raise taxes in the middle of a recession. We've got enough in there so that we can keep it solvent. Last biennium, we smoothed out the jump between
3 and 4 or 4 and 5?
3 and 4. The jump between tax rate 3, I wasn't here last session, so I'm not as conversant with it. The jump between 3 and 4 was a lot steeper than that, and we lowered tax rate 4 so that it would be a smoother a glide path into that tax rate. Also, during the special sessions over the summer, the legislature adopted a $20 increase in weekly benefits and a two-quarter reduction in taxes for employers, which took place the last two quarters of last year. So there has been a little bit of play on this system, but overall it's worked very well for a number of years to keep that trust fund in balance and solvent.
It must have been very persuasive, or we have no idea. Representative Hanson,
would you anticipate any further adjustments during the session?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, no. We just moved this calendar year into tax schedule four. We had hoped to stay there for two or three years. It's going to depend an awful lot on whether we get out of this recession or not. Back last spring, we had projected that we would stay in four for at least two more years. But then as the recession kept going, benefits stretched out. We got extended benefits and the level of benefits are higher because there's a higher, the average benefit is higher because we're getting a lot of professionals laid off, people who had a lot higher salaries than we've had in the last recession. So the trust fund has dipped more. So it's a possibility we'll go into five next calendar year, but it will depend an awful lot on what the economy looks like.
What's the impact of the extended benefits that the federal government gave to Oregon on this trust fund?
On this trust fund, temporary extended unemployment benefits were all paid out of the federal trust fund. So that did not have an impact on us. The extended benefits, which were 50-50, and this is real complicated because we had extended benefits and then we had the federal extended, and we kind of went back and forth. Do we know what the impact of the state extended benefits? Let me bring that back to you. Okay. It wasn't huge. If you look here, it's not on the chart because it makes it real complicated, but this pot of money has some other pots out here. One's available for states to borrow from when they bust the trust funds, and that gets repaid with interest. One's available for extended benefits, and it's paid 100% out of that pot. And then there's a third pot when all those are full and not needed. It's called the READ Act money, which is supposed to come back to the states. You may have heard of that over the summer. We did get a READ Act distribution. So there's some other resources at the state level, one of which pays for temporary extended benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of the different tax statuses here,
mm-hmm.
Where did we go in terms of state taxes? In terms of extended benefits, would we be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we are currently in four, and that takes care of our extended benefits.
Okay.
If we were, if that were to go on and the economy didn't recover, we would probably bump into five next session. The extended benefits haven't had a big impact on which tax schedule we're in this year. We'll have to see what it looks like. And we take a look at this in August of every year, see where the trust fund is and whether or not we'll be bumping into the next schedule. So next August, depending on whether we're still in as deep a recession as we have been, we'll be able to figure out if that. The extended benefits have not had a major impact on which tax schedule we've been in.
And the reason, Mr. Chairman, I was asking this question, because many people look at the ending balance of the trust fund,
mm-hmm.
And they have great concerns many times, like the employer benefit, you know, the tax rate should go down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if that were to go down, if we had allowed that to go down last session or the session before, the condition that we would be in by now, especially with the extended benefits having to come out of the program. So are you comfortable with the contribution rates that are presently made by employers and don't think that we need to send some of that money back, or you feel comfortable with the contributions now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we're comfortable.
Okay.
And I'm backed up by actuaries
and
smart
people,
but I'm comfortable.
Because of your advisory board and where they are and with those business people being on there, they're comfortable with it.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like it's well managed, and I'm not questioning that. Actually, I'm wondering if our abundance of caution is now translated into an advantage for Oregon. My question would be, are our tax rates lower than surrounding states that appear to be less conservatively managed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, I can't tell you what those tax rates are, but I know that a number of my colleagues around the country have had to raise taxes and have gotten into pretty huge political battles over that because they're raising taxes in the middle of a big recession. Texas, for example, again, has to fill its trust fund back up. We went from Schedule 3 to Schedule 4 without a peep this in December. We didn't hear, I don't think we heard anything from any employers about that increase because employers have been able to foresee these kinds of things. So, yeah, I think our tax rates are very reasonable compared to what other states are going to have to do this coming year.
Thank you for the information, by the way. This is very helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Real quick question and then a comment. On the BRF fund, in this low interest environment, is that causing any problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, yes, it is. We are looking at a real fall off in that CDEF. The CDAF fund that we actually spend, our interest rate has dropped. We'd anticipated 6, and we're down to 3, I think. So, yeah, and as we go into work session, you'll see, and Satish has some information, too, that we are losing money there. And we'll have to really take a close look at services because of that.
The other quick comment is, looking at the way you've managed the trust fund, I kind of wish we'd funded education in that manner over the last decade.
First.
That hurts. That's harsh.
Well, Debbie, I think that is. Excuse me.
Oh,
question?
I'm just co-signing with Representative Krieger.
Okay. Debbie, I think it is kind of interesting when you look at it. If you think about it, Oregon with 1.4, Washington with almost double our population, only 1.6. In California, with 10 times our population, being what, 3.5 times as much? The question would be asked, well, is that too much? As you look at other states, do you think that we have too much there? Or, I mean, it just depends how long this recession would go before we start thinking, well, maybe that wasn't even an adequate amount.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, it's really hard to make that judgment. States are responsible for their own benefit. The federal government doesn't set benefit levels. Each state is able to set those benefit levels. So it's a little bit hard to compare state to state because you don't know for sure what it is their benefit schedule is. That's an excellent policy discussion. Is it adequate? Is it too much? Is it not enough? What kind of risk do you want to take with the solvency of that trust fund?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we haven't gotten in trouble like other states because we don't have a rogue legislature.
Rogue? Okay.
We're pretty conservative. We are. I mean, our legislature has not robbed UI like some other legislatures have across the country. And so I think that speaks well for our state. And that's why we rate so well in the bond market, because of how our legislature respect the fact of trust funds and spend bottom line dollars. And we've had this rating for over 30 years on the bond market.
That concludes our presentation on questions, and we can go back to, we've got two more programs to talk about, our child care division and our hearings panel. So if you're ready, I can ask Tom Olson to come up to do the child care division. And while Tom is coming up, we're back into the document we gave you yesterday. which is the was the performance measures document. And Tom will be starting on page 21 of that document.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Olson, administrator of the Child Care Division. I'm going to talk a little bit on page 21 about child care performance measures. We only have one performance measure that was adopted by the Progress Board. We used to have a number, and they thought they were probably irrelevant at this point, and they adopted 471-14, which is the percent of family child care centers required to have health and safety reviews by the Child Care Division. And the performance measure on that one is, of course, extremely important. I think Senator George may remember a couple sessions ago we had quite a flack about family child care and the fact that the state had never inspected family child care. And I think Senator George made the comment that they inspect my filbert orchard more than we expect the places that are taking care of our kids. And it was true. It was true. And since that time, we have done on-site reviews of every registered family child care facility in the state of Oregon. Last year, we did about 2,300 reviews total. And the purpose of this performance measure, it's 100%, and it will remain 100%. And the idea is that if you ever see it drop below 100%, then we got problems, because either the money isn't there to ensure the safety of the children, or we're not doing our job, one of the two. The other performance measures you see on this chart are the performance measures that we've created as a child care system in collaboration with our partners. Child care is a very collaborative system. We involve everybody in our process. And it's great fun because they're all great people and they all have the same, you know, interest of kids at heart. But it does take time to get consensus. And so we've been working on these things for about 2 years now. And we have a list of 16 of them. And they're divided up into our main mission areas of safety, quality, affordability, and accessibility. And it's an attempt to design some measures that are, number one, measurable and available, because you've got to be able to get the data. And number two, have some research behind them that shows that they really make a difference in the area that you're measuring. And so we've set these for ourselves. They're our own benchmarks. Oregon has two child care-related benchmarks. They're the ones that are shaded on this page. And we just didn't feel that was enough. We wanted to be able to come back in subsequent biennia when we get data on these things and tell you whether or not we're moving the needle and how much, and if we're not, why not. A lot of the measures are related to data that we gather through the household survey that Oregon does every 2 years. We have a number of child care related questions on there, and we get really good information on that. Oregon probably has better information for child care planning than any other state because we've been doing it for a long time. We take research seriously. A lot of states respond to a lot of other, influences in terms of setting child care policy. We try to base ours on what makes sense and what is backed up by research as much as possible.
Senator Dukes?
I was just curious. I don't think we've given this to you to do, so if the answer is no, I'll understand. But do you do anything to encourage people to into the child care provider? We seem to come up a little short here. I mean, not that that's a surprise to anybody with children, but for every 100 need, we've got 20 slots. That's a huge shortage. Is
Mr.
anybody
Chair.
Out there encouraging?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, yes, there are. Child care supply is a very difficult thing to measure because there are a lot of, there are probably, 65% of working women have children, for instance. But not all of them require what we consider to be formal child care. They make all kinds of arrangements. Parents, there've been again going back to research.
Single parent, I know what you do.
They do things you would not believe to collaborate together arrangements that work for them. And when we talk about things like child care quality, we're not always focusing on programs that do a lot of educational activities. We also look at parent flexibility as an element of quality, and the fact that they may well choose a neighbor next door because they have to work shift work. But To answer your question, what we do is we provide funding to the commissions on children and families, and the commissions are charged to go out and look at, in their planning process that they do under Senate Bill 555, they look at the child care supply available in their county, and they decide for themselves where they, kind of the areas they want to spend that money on. Do they want to increase the supply of infants and toddlers, for instance? In some areas that have manufacturing plants, what they want to do is to increase the supply of odd-hour child care that, for folks that work shift work. So there's about as many many types of solutions out there as there are counties, and we try to leave that as much as possible to the county level. And the local child care resource and referral agencies also, there's 16 of them in the state, they also work really hard to encourage child care providers to go into the profession. Now, it's not a good time to be doing that. Child care is a very poorly paid occupation, and we really are trying to do something about that. There have been various, there was a bill last session for a program called Oregon Cares, for instance, and we've got some pilot projects going on in the state that really try to reward child care providers that have certain levels of training and education by giving them stipends once a year that that recognizes their training and their professionalism. And in that way, what we try to do is to encourage the providers that are really intentional, that we really want to remain in child care and do it well, to stay in child care. And we encourage them to, if they're only caring for five kids, we tell them, you can care for up to 10. What we'd like to do, since you're such a good provider, we'd like to see you at maximum capacity and increase your business. And to that effect, we also provide money for the resource and referral agencies to provide business education classes to providers so they can learn how to run a business out of their house, because this is a business, and that's the reason that we've increased the regulatory activity on family child care. Oregon finally understood that child care providers are in business. I'm sorry, that was a very long
answer.
No,
that was a great answer. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I just want to give kudos, if you don't mind. We have a problem in, we don't have one child care center in North Portland. In our area, we've been working on that. And I called Debbie, and she sent Tom out, and we started working, but of course I resigned and left the job, but we're still going to work on some issues of child care. And I just want to give kudos, because I think too many times we don't give state workers kudos where they need to be given. And I want to thank you for your efforts in child care. I don't know, we always think women as the nurturer, but I don't know anybody who works harder than Tom Olson to try to make sure that we have quality child care in the commission. So kudos to you for your work.
Well, thank you, and that and we look at child care as not a women's issue either. It's a societal issue. It has to be part of the social infrastructure. We're just now learning how important those first years are, and how much of an impact they have on the development of kids when they get ready to go into school.
Mr. Chair, can you talk to us a little bit about the affordability here, but about minimum wage type single parents, you know, even now at $690 by the time you take child care, and how many of them know what programs are there to help them and things of that nature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's it's a significant problem. The working poor have less access to good child care than anybody else in the state. There's just no doubt about that. Nationally, they figure that about 10% of working families that are low income and eligible to receive child care subsidies actually receive the subsidies. In Oregon, it's about 12%. But that's still peanuts. But, of course, there's no money to do it. What we're spending every dollar we get, and we're 97% federally funded, more than that, I guess, now. And so the federal dollars that come in, we contract with the Department of Human Services to provide the child care subsidy program. And they work as hard as they can to get everybody involved that they can. But there's only so much money to go around. And there's also a policy question that we're taking on right now, too. The policy decision we've always made in Oregon is that we provide a little bit of child care subsidy to as many people as we possibly can. We provide a little bit of money. But we have really high copayments. And the parents that are the working poor, for instance, they can have a copayment of $200 a month if they're at 160% of poverty. I mean, that's a big copayment to help with their child care. Other states will, for instance, do some states do waiting lists, and then they concentrate the subsidy by paying providers better and making sure that the quality of care is better. Oregon has, because we do this because we even out the subsidy, there's a lot of informal care involved in the state. A lot of low-income working poor are not in regulated or licensed child care programs. They're being taken care of by what we call exempt providers, the neighbors, the grandma, somebody down the street that isn't really trained to do it, isn't licensed to do it, is doing it to help this family out. And it is. It's a tremendous problem, and I wish we could do something about it. Unless we get a whole lot more money in the system, we can't.
Would the individual who might be considering becoming a provider, would they face anything if they're 10 or less children as far as zoning, being able to utilize their home, or is there a state preemption on that?
Senator George, there is. We have a statutory exemption that does not allow family child care to be zoned out of neighborhoods. If it's a center, they can be, because that's a business, that's a standalone, but this is if it's the care is being provided at a family residence, there is no zoning preemption.
Again, Mr. Chair, one of the problems that surfaced in my district is the relationship between the state funds that go to child care providers and kind of the time lag, timely payment issues, and then sometimes not receiving the payments because of the client problems in terms of getting the right paperwork, sometimes following through on their job searches and stuff to render them ineligible, which becomes a real surprise to the provider when they don't get their check. And I was wondering if you do any work with your providers in terms of educating them to the state requirements and especially how the paperwork flows, or if that's a common state problem that you hear from providers that this kind of instability of the way the state provides the repayments. I've had child providers that have had to go on food stamps because delays in getting the checks from the state of Oregon, which is a I would imagine if I was in that business and it happened once or twice, I'd find a different business to go into.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, it is a problem, and the child care subsidy program in Oregon, again, we do things just a little bit differently. In many states, the subsidy program and the lead agency and the licensing program are in the same agency here. The subsidy program is run by the Department of Human Services, and we work really closely with them, and even more closely now because as of last session, the money that comes from the federal government that's used for the subsidy, it used to be a revenue transfer. So basically the money just went right to the Department of Human Services. Now it's coming over as a special payment. So we are now, as of this year, in a position of contracting with the Department of Human Services, and that gives us a little bit more leverage to look at things together with them about how can we make these problems go away. And a lot of it is the fact that they have a computer system that was built before I was born, I swear. And they just don't have the money to upgrade it. So things do get lost through the cracks. Other states have gone to things like smart cards or electronic benefits payment. I mean, it just deposited immediately into the accounts. The department does as much of that sort of thing as they possibly can within their technological limitations. And they have just recently revised their application form, for instance, so it's a one-page form. They're trying to reduce everything they can outside of building a great new electronic information system. They're doing everything they can to try to make that happen, but it's still happening. I understand that, and we're working with them on it.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Could we go back to the LFO report with respect to the child care accounting? Including the cover, belong to the it'd be the sixth page. I don't see the number. But I was noticing the 03, the last 03 legislative approved budget of $1,970,000 and the governor's recommended budget of $3,627,000 with only three increases in FTE. I was wondering if there's an explanation for that increase.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I can tell you that the biggest part of the, if you take a look at the 0103 legislatively adopted number of 4.1 million, mm-hmm. that was the number that was approved by the legislature in the last session. During the special sessions that were held during the interim, much of that funding was deleted. General fund money was deleted. And there was, I believe, about $400,000 that was deleted in the second special session. And then in the third special session, there is $1.75 million general fund that was deleted, and the department was instructed to backfill that with penalty and interest money, which will be reflected here as other funds. You'll see the other funds line substantially increased. It was a fund shift from general fund to other fund on a one-time basis. So that legislatively approved number, the $1.97 million, is the number after the five special sessions have taken place.
So presumably you've shifted all the funds you can shift, and you're back to a more normal accounting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, that's correct. At the time of the third special session, the legislature looked at what general fund was left in the department, and they estimated at the $1.75 million and instructed the department to backfill that with other funds on a one-time basis. And so now for the 0305, it's back up to approaches the 0103 legislatively adopted number, although the governor in his budget reduced that by 10%, I believe, about $400,000.
Okay, thank you.
If you'll turn briefly to page 22, we have, I did some quick program comparisons with the child care division and other states. And there's really no rhyme or reason for the states, except I tried to pick ones that had approximately the same population size as Oregon and states where I could find data, because you can't always do that. So what I did was take a look at, I thought what might be useful to you is to look at the licensing budgets of the various states and look at the number of facilities they had and then divide and to see how much each state spends per facility on licensing costs. And based on that, Oregon's about in the middle, a little bit on the low side. And then over to the right-hand side of that chart is some information about how we regulate. And it's the staff-to-child ratios, which is a fairly common measure to use to compare regulatory agencies, of how many individuals to, or how many children to one staff states allow in both family child care, which are the smaller home-based programs, and child care centers. And again, we're about in the middle. Our regulatory program is a good average program, and I think with the amount of money we have, we do it about as well as anyone does.
I think that concludes our child care presentation. Mm-hmm. If there are questions, we can go on to the hearings panel.
Okay.
And I'd like to introduce Tom Ewing, who is the Chief Hearings Officer for the hearings panel, and he will start with page 23.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Ewing. I'm the Chief Hearing Officer, and I lead the Hearing Officer panel for the state of Oregon. If you would turn to page 23, I have two charts, which I hope will be of some interest to you. The first is performance measures. It's called a lower authority appeals. Mm-hmm. Actually, we're talking about unemployment insurance hearings that are a part of the hearing officer panel. You'll see that in the, and there's been a fair bit of discussion the last couple of days about the effects of the recession upon us all, and not least upon the employment department. This chart, I think, reflects the effect upon unemployment insurance hearings. There are three federal timelines. One is that, first is to get 60% of our orders out within 30 days, 80% of our orders must be out within 45 days, and 95% must be out within 60 days. You'll see that in year 2001 and 2002, we have failed to meet the 60%, what's called the A date, the first federal requirement that I referred to. And that's a matter of no little concern to us, although our circumstance is not unique. Across the nation, with the increase in unemployment insurance claims, and especially in Oregon and Washington, Washington has a central panel similar to Oregon's, also has unemployment insurance. They, too, have been struggling with the same issue. The number of referrals that have come to us has increased by 40% from about 14,000 in the year 2000, now to 20 to 21,000 in the year 2002. But we're managing that, and slowly but surely we're looking at a lot of creative ways to try to improve our performance. So you'll see that star, those are the stars, those are the goals that we have set for us to pull ourselves out of the recession, excuse me, of the our federal failure to meet the timelines. If you would like, I will turn to ask you to turn to pages 24 and 25. This is a report I did for the Oversight Committee. The Oversight Committee, as some of you may not know, is a committee comprised of senators, representatives, appointees of the governor, of the attorney general. I sit on it ex officio. I prepared this in the year 2001 for the Oversight Committee. Since I was asked to give you some comparative data, we don't really have any comparing central panels. This is something that I produced for myself to put the hearing officer panel, this central panel, in the context nationally of other central panels. There are 22. Oregon is the newest, and it is also the largest. We have, and this, by the way, is the year 2000 data. I don't have anything that's newer than this, but for Oregon, for example, you'll see that the number of hearings is 27,000. Well, actually, it's gone up to about 37,000 now in the last couple of years. But we are one of the largest in the nation, and if you have any particular questions on that, you can see that the size of panels varies enormously from Missouri, which has only three administrative law judges, to Oregon, one of the largest, that has 80. The range of jurisdiction is also enormous. You'll see that the number of hearings varies considerably. Some central panels will only hear professional licensing boards, and then you'll have panels like Oregon and like Washington's where we hear just about everything. We hear the, and I'll be talking about this tomorrow more, but just to finish up my thought, we hear the hearings for roughly 70 agencies. That's about over 90% of all the contested cases for the state of Oregon. So the range of our jurisdiction is quite enormous, and tomorrow I'll give you perhaps a better flavor of that. Oh.
This is it.
Does that explain the California numbers being so low relative to the population difference?
Yes, sir. You know,
they have units that are handling this rather than one central.
That's correct. They have made a policy choice to create a central panel, but to keep most of their agency hearings within within the agencies that have heard these hearings traditionally. And that, of course, goes to the policy choice of the hearing officer panel and 22 other states have made. Is it the right thing to do for citizens to have a state agency impose a sanction or revoke a license or whatever the agency chooses to do, and the citizen then has a hearing before the very agency that wants to impose this sanction? So that's the policy choice, and legislatures have answered it differently.
Senator Duke?
I don't have a question on what you're talking about right now, but I do back on page 23, that lower graph there. Could you explain that?
The lower authority appeals quality. What this is, the federal government has issued a bulletin, ETA 382, and in this bulletin, it's about that thick, there are a lot of different standards that we are to meet in terms of the order itself. For example, both in the order and in the hearing. To give you an example, at the beginning of the hearing, we're supposed to inform the citizen of what the issue is. We're supposed to provide all parties with the opportunity to cross-examine. I can't remember all of them, but there are, in the order portion, we're supposed to succinctly describe what is the final decision of the hearing officer. So those are the quality standards that have been set by the federal government. We've done overall over the years very, very well, but obviously, again, affected by the recession, that's declined.
We're still at 99%.
Yes.
Excuse me, Representative Hanson.
Thank you. The 27,000 hearings, or 37,000. Now, are those hearings that the whole hearing that the hearing panel does for all state agencies, or are we just focusing on employment hearings?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, those are the hearings that the referrals, that is the cases that have come to us from all agencies, all 70 agencies is the total.
Is there any comparison in terms of the number of appeals and the number of hearings just in the employment area and how that stacks up with other states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, we do keep that information. What I do not know, because I'm not a specialist in unemployment insurance, is whether there is comparative data from other states. I'm very interested in comparative data from other states. I have looked for a variety of things, not that specifically. I don't recall coming across that. I would have remembered had I. My suspicion is, I guess in sum, is I don't think that that information is held. I have been surprised a little bit that there is not more on the Bureau of Labor's website, that there is not more comparative data comparing the progress, the performance of UI hearings across the nation. They've been doing more of that in the last couple of years, but that's not a statistic I remember seeing.
One of the areas I'm concerned with is that whether some employers have a pattern of just automatically denying benefits and then going to appeal every decision just in terms of stringing their employees out and hoping that they'll get another job quicker. And I don't, anecdotally, I think that's possible, but I have no way whether it's just anecdotal and is the appearance of that or whether that's a real problem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, I think you asked me that when I met with you earlier, and we went back and looked, and we can't find anything that indicates that there's a pattern of that with any company. I think you're right. There probably are anecdotal instances of one or two companies doing that, but we can't find a pattern of that with any specific company based on our records.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have completed your report. Thanks.
That ends our portion of the presentation, Mr. Chairman, and you're ready to turn it over to Satish.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be talking to you about the Governor's budget for the Employment Department for the 2003-2005 biennium. You should have a copy of my presentation document in front of you. If you will turn to page 2, you will see that the total budget consists of $1.85 billion total funds. This is a 7.4% decrease from the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The budget consists of $3.63 million general fund, and this is for the child care division. Are you trying to find
this one? There I go. Thank you. Got it. Just far over the word.
Yes. And as Senator Morse mentioned earlier, if you look at the columns on the right, you will see that there's a decrease in general fund from the 2001-2003 close of session budget, but there's a huge increase from the 2001-2003 budget through the fifth special session. That's due to the various actions that took place during the special sessions, and I'll be talking more about this in a minute. If you turn to page 3, the pie chart there shows the various fund types that make up this budget. you will notice that non-limited other funds account for the largest portion, 80% of the budget, with $1.47 billion. Now, these funds are used to pay benefits to unemployment insurance claimants, and the estimated payments are based on the latest economic forecast prepared by the Department of Administrative Services. This budget assumes that there will be 1,063,581 claims filed during 2003-2005.
What was that number again?
It's 1,063,581 initial claims. Now, that was the number when that the agency came up with when the budget was created. I think that's going to change depending on how long the recession is going to last. So. The second largest portion of the budget consists of federal funds. About 45% of the federal funds is in the child care division, and 55% is for unemployment insurance and employment services. Now, other funds account for 6.3% of the budget, and the sources of other funds are interest earnings from state unemployment tax revenues that are held in the reserve before being sent to the U.S. Treasury, the Reed Act funds, Debbie talked a little bit about it earlier, and other revenues that the department generates. Now, general fund, it's only in the child care division, and it is a very small percentage of this agency's budget, just 0.2%. Turning to page 4, now the major changes that were approved by the 2002 first to the fifth special session. First, during the second special session, there was a reduction of $501,992 general fund dollars from the child care division budget. Now, during the third special session, there was a one-time replacement of $1.75 million general fund from the child care division budget. This was replaced with penalty and interest earnings. These are interest earnings and penalties on delinquent payment of employment taxes. And the other action that took place during the special sessions was, as you'll see in the budgets of all state agencies, adjustments for employee compensation increases for 0103. Now, what does the governor's budget do? The governor's budget continues all existing level of core services. It restores the $1.75 million of general fund that was reduced during the third special session from the child care division budget. Because of general fund constraints, it reduces funding for the Child Care Resource and Referral Network by 8%, and this comes to a little bit more than $400,000. And the budget provides funding to expand the implementation of the telephone initial claim call centers so unemployment insurance claimants can file claims through the Internet or through the phone. They won't have to go to the offices in person. And lastly, the budget adds 4 permanent positions, and it continues 25 limited duration positions. If you will turn to page 5, the pie chart there shows the various program units and what percentage of the budget that they have. Again, you will notice that the largest percentage is non-limited funds. That is 79% of the budget, and that is to pay unemployment insurance benefits. Turning to page 6, this shows the various budget categories. Again, special payments consists of 86% of the department's budget. Special payments, they are mostly in two areas. One is the non-limited area with $1.47 billion, and the other one is in the child care division with $109.8 million. There's a very small percentage of debt service. This is for the Eugene building. I believe that was approved by the last legislature, a very small amount of money. Personal services consists of 9.49%, services and supplies 4.37%, and capital outlay 0.03%. Now, if we'll turn to page 7, I would now like to walk you through how the governor's budget was developed. The starting point was the 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget. This consists of $1.69 billion total funds. This was increased as a result of the various legislatively approved actions through April 2002, as well as there was an increase in non-limited funds that we can do administratively due to the increase in benefits. The main legislative actions that took place were there was a reduction of the $501,992 general fund dollars during the second special session from the child care division budget. There was an increase in federal funds and other funds due to increase in unemployment insurance workload. This was approved by the emergency board. There was an increase in federal funds to provide assistance to victims of the groundfish commercial fishery failure. There was also an increase in federal funds to conduct research on child care data. And lastly, there was an increase in federal funds for a pilot unemployment insurance claimant reemployment project. The total increase through the legislatively approved actions, as well as the administrative increase of the non-limited other funds, consists of $296.8 million. Next, we come into the base budget adjustments. There was a roll-up of the 2001-2003 positions, actions and compensation changes. This was an increase of $19.9 million total funds. And there was also a very small base debt service adjustment of a reduction of $210 federal funds. And also there was a base non-limited adjustment of $156.4 million of non-limited other funds. The reason why we have this huge decrease is the 2001-2003 budget was based on there being 1,143,927 initial claims. But this time, we are just assuming that the number of initial claims will go down to 1,063,581. That's why you see that huge decrease. If you will turn to page 8, now here we have the essential packages. There was an increase of $206,861 total funds for the non-position information control system personal services adjustments. This consists of standard inflationary increases for temporary employment appointments, overtime, and shift differential. And there's also an adjustment for vacancy savings. One thing you may find helpful is in the governor's budget binder, if you turn to page B39, there's a form there that walks you through all that. I was reluctant to point you to that form because they have a term there that we are not supposed to use. It's called the current service level. Yes, yes, that binder. If you turn to page B39, what I'm saying you'll see in this form. It's B39. And next, on package 020, we have adjustments for cost of phase-ins and phase-out of programs. This is a reduction of $1.5 million total funds. There is a phase-in for services and surprise costs for positions that have been authorized for 18 months in the current biennium. For the next biennium, now we need those to be there for 24 months, so there's a phase-in amount. There's also a phase-out of services and supplies costs related to 52 limited-duration positions that will end of this biennium. So there's a huge negative increase because of that. Package 030, it provides inflation for services and supplies and special payments. The department did not request any exceptions. We provided the standard 3.5% inflation for almost everything except for special payments in child care. There was a 3.9% inflation. And for Attorney General, the agency's budget consists of just around 11% inflation, which is lower than the maximum amount that agencies are allowed to request. That's 12.7. And there's also an adjustment for state government service charges. If we go to now page 9, under mandated caseload, you'll see a reduction of 935,672 federal funds and 7 positions. This is because of the projected reduction in unemployment insurance programs. You notice the $156 million reductions. That is the benefits amount. Now, this reduction is related to the workload related to that. Under package 050, you will see a fund shift of, it nets out to $618,000 total funds. There was a replacement of 7,819,405 federal funds with 7,812,589 other funds to offset a reduction in the federal unemployment revenues to support the unemployment insurance program. And the source of the other funds is the WEDAC funds. Now, the policy packages. There are 8 policy packages, and we'll start with package 070. These are there are 3 reduction revenue reductions. The first one is in the Develop Workforce and Protect Employment Program. There's a reduction of $1.4 million other funds and elimination of 9 positions. These funds were provided to the department during the by the emergency board. These have remained unscheduled. These were never used. So we don't want it to carry forward to the next biennium, so that's why there's a, it is shown as a revenue reduction. In the child care division, there's a reduction, there's a removal of a one-time $12.9 million federal fund special payments that will not be available in 2003-05. And in the central hearings panel, there's a reduction of $1.6 million and elimination of 8 positions. When the agency put its budget together, it worked with the client agencies and to make sure that the client agencies would be able to offer the to pay for these services. So based on discussions with the client agencies, we have revenue reductions. Now if you turn to page 10, policy packages, package 080 is a technical adjustment during the during the June emergency board. There was a position reclassification package, and there was a reduction of $6,816. Package 081, this also you will see in every agency budget. This is the removal of the $38,737 other funds for the 3% cost of living adjustments for employees who are at salary range 38 and higher. Package 090 is a reduction of $417,137 other funds and 2 full-time equivalent positions in the central hearings panel. This reduction was made during the governor's budget process based on the governor's budget for client agencies. And package 092, additional program reductions. This is a reduction of payments to the Child Care Resource and Referral Network by $404,968 general fund. This reduction is done because of general fund constraints. If you'll turn to page 11, now we have the 3 policy packages. Package 201, telephone initial claims. This package increases other funds expenditure limitation by $4 million to enable the department to use READ Act funds to implement the telephone initial claims call centers for unemployment insurance program. Right now there are 2 call centers. In 2003-2005, the department plans to establish 3 more call centers. And the department is still working on the details. We are bringing this package forward because it takes the full legislative body to authorize the use of READ Act funds. And I would recommend that you ask the Department of Administrative Services to unschedule these funds until the department has a more specific plan. Package 202, fraud control. This increases other funds expenditure limitation by $398,629 other funds to establish 2 revenue agent 1 positions. Again, we talked, or the agency talked a little bit about account receivables. The goal is these positions are will be able to increase biennial collections by $2 million. So each position would be increasing collections by $1 million per biennium. And there's also an information system specialist position to carry out various benefit payment control programming projects. So this is a revenue-generating package. Package 203, employment contracted services. Now you have seen these packages also in the past biennium. This package increases other funds expenditure limitation by $3.4 million and continues 25 limited duration positions to work on grants and contracts. And it also converts 1 limited duration geographic information system position into a permanent position. You will see that they are requesting 25 positions here, and of course it raises questions, but this is a package that has also been in the past. This is to continue work on grants and contracts. During 1991-2001, the legislature approved 33 positions for a similar package. In 2001-2003, there were 41 positions approved. So, in conclusion, the governor's budget basically it maintains current level of operations. It restores the $1.75 million general fund that was reduced from the child care division budget during the third special session. It reduces funding for the child care resource and referral network by 8% due to general fund constraints. It provides funding to expand the implementation of the telephone information claim centers, establish three more centers between 2003-2005, and it adds four permanent positions and continues 25 limited duration positions. Do you have any questions?
Representative Hanson. Thank you. We got two questions. One, on the one-time $1.7 million movement that we did during the special session, if that was based on penalty and interest dollars, and is there any way that there's additional penalty and interest dollars that we can use either to backfill the $4 million or the $400,000 general fund cut, or free up some general fund? I mean, if we did it once, why can't we just do it over and over again?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanson, it put a strain on employment services programs that are funded by the penalty and interest money. If we were to lose that federal or the general fund money, we would have to backfill it with the federal funds from the federal fund block grant, which would cut back resources to the Child Care Resource and Referral Group. Our top priority, obviously, is safe child care, and that general fund supports the inspections of centers. So we probably would backfill it with federal funds, but it would reduce the resources going out to the counties.
The other question, and this is more generic, in the base budget adjustments, we've got the roll up of position actuals and compensation changes. I guess what I don't understand is, with the governor's suggestion of a wage freeze throughout the state, how that's going to differentiate, what the impact is that going to have on positions that are primarily either federal funded or other funded, and if we drive some savings there, where will those funds go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, yes, that is an issue. Just looking at page B39 that I pointed, I think because of the governor's directions, there will be, let's see, I want to make sure I look at the right number, there should be almost a reduction of $2.8 million to the agency's budget, and this will include other funds as well as federal funds. Now, what we will need to do is sit with the agencies and see if any of those funds can be used to backfill the general fund. But that's something we need to sit with them and do. And at this point, DAS is working on the impact of the governor's directives on various agencies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, there's a couple of issues here. One, you need to understand that base budget adjustment of $19.9 million is the roll-up costs of salary increases and merits and flexible benefits and PERS and all those things that took place during the 2001-03 biennium. The salary freeze that's being talked about now are freezing salaries at the level of July 1, 2003 for the next biennium. There will be no increases during the next biennium. And as Satish mentioned, we will be working with DAS and the department to determine what that number is going to be. And you'll see those adjustments when we go into work session, and they will be adjustments for all fund types, including general fund, other fund, and federal fund positions.
Chairman, a question. Mm-hmm. Debbie, what's the likelihood of dissatisfaction in the ranks in terms of freezing of salary, and what's the potential of a lawsuit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, nobody wants to see a wage. I think cross state government, you're going to see dissatisfaction. I certainly, we're in bargaining now. I certainly couldn't speak for the union. I don't see any grounds for a lawsuit. But I'm not a lawyer either.
I'm curious. There's a lot of inflation in here, and now we're taking that out. Is that all going to be pulled out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dinks, much of that inflation is also scheduled to be backed out. Now, some of that, the Attorney General and the Central Government Service Charges and those things, those rates will be determined when those agencies' budget is determined, and the adjustments will come back in for those. But most of the inflation, or at least a lot of much of the inflation that you see in there, will also be coming out during work session. And from all agencies.
Okay, and I was curious about the 11% for the Attorney General. This is driven by the AG's office, is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that is driven by the AG's office. So when the AG's office budget comes before, I think it's before the Public Safety Subcommittee, and that will be dependent on that. Then the guidelines allowed agencies up to 12.7 to ask request up to 12.7% inflation for Attorney General. Employment Department has just requested around 11%, a little more than 11%.
So that 11% doesn't reflect anything that the Employment Division has done, but rather what's going on in the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it is both. What's going on in there as well as how much the Department has been using the AG's office.
Can you break down? I'm trying to get a feel. Is the Employment Division needing to use the Attorney General's office a lot more and anticipating a lot more usage in 0305, and that's why it's going up, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't think that is the reason. I think the reason is because the AG hourly rates are also going up.
Senator Morris, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Debbie, when typically are commitments made in the collective bargaining process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, bargaining usually goes on into May and June. The contract itself expires on June 30th. So if everything goes well and we have an agreement, a new contract would be in place on July 1. So I think the whole thing, the whole process is dependent a little bit on the legislature and what all the parties involved see happening with the budget discussions.
Mr. Chair, was the governor's budget then based on, part of it at least based on the 13.6% revenue increase if you take out the one-time money? So that means we're going to have to take it on down to where the co-chairs are talking about 10%. And that's even being looked at now with the projected March, May. So just, yeah, increases will be difficult.
Have you completed your report to us?
I have, Mr. Chair, unless you have any questions.
Director?
I have, well, actually, Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Representative Krieger a little bit. I think most that discussion is around general fund.
Right.
Our increases, as I mentioned, our federal funds, if we don't spend them here, the feds will give them to another state to spend them. So I just want to leave you with that thought. Thank you very much. This has been a very pleasant committee to work with, and we look forward to coming back for work session.
Can I ask you a question?
And I think it's my question is more for you. we were told in full committee that agencies should present us with a prioritized list of add-backs and of reductions. I don't know how an agency like this does that, but is this something we should be asking these folks?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, we gave you a prioritized list of services. We also have given the Department of Administrative Services a 30% cut list, which actually I don't have in front of me at the moment.
Well, I'm sure
but the
book somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We know where that is. What tab under what book? Or?
We need to get that to you.
Chair and members of the committee, I have that, and I can distribute that to you later today.
Okay.
It's not in your books, but I'll get that to you.
And where's the prioritized list?
It's on page 4 of this handout that they started on yesterday.
Oh,
Mr. Chair.
I think another policy discussion the committee might want to think about, and that is because there are those who feel that federal funds are still funds that should be looked at. But the one thing that I did notice that I have worked hard for since 1984 here, and that is that Oregon does not receive its generally amount of dollars that we are eligible for from the federal government, as it is. And I'd like to see, I feel very comfortable with the employment department having their increases in the federally funded area. But how does the committee feel about that is another thing. And I'd like for us not to get into a big battle once we're doing the budget itself, but to have a clarified position in terms of the direction in which we're going as it relates to that, and go from there, even in the larger committee, because I do know that our colleague, the co-chair from the House, have special feelings about that as well. And so rather than for us to get into the throes of this budget, and these folk have to go back to the drawing board because they're not allowed to have their increase in federal funds, I'd rather for that conversation to take place up front.
Well, I agree with you, and if you actually list, you know, if we considered everything that we talked about, it would actually appear that we were demanding more rather than less.
Right.
And so, and that is a question that I immediately ran to the co-chairs with is, well, what do we do about this? We're 98% of this committee is going to be looking at basically federal dedicated funds.
Exactly.
So what do we do with it? And, of course, their recommendation to us was consider very definitely the loss of any federal funds and to make your decision very thoughtfully, particularly where we have someone that because of the downturn is really impacted or can have an effect and influence on recovery.
It certainly could.
Caring for those who have lost their jobs.
Because we have so many people that are not enjoying the revenue stream right now. And that affects the amount of dollars that goes into the business coffer. And it also affects the individual income tax need. And so somewhere along the line, we've got to realize what that balance is all about.
Right.
Because if the taxes from business and from individuals continue to go down, we aren't going to be able to take care of basic critical services. And so it's just something that I I'd like to that I'm grateful that this committee then would like to see this department function at a level of efficiency that it can based upon the fact that they don't have the general funds, but certainly the federal funds are available to them.
Right. And that is one thing I'll be asking each one of you as we go through this process, and it doesn't need to occur in the formal meeting, but keep me informed of your opinions.
Right.
And I will relay those back to the co-chairs.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you have mine now.
Make a note of it.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions or comments from the committee? With that, I will, and I want to thank each one of you for being here. It's been very informative, a very pleasant group to work with on your side of the table, too. And we appreciate that very much. And with that, I'll close the public hearing. Oh, is there anyone from, I don't see anyone out there. We have no one signed up. Let's make sure we give it an opportunity for anyone to speak who has something to say or question to ask. Okay, with that, I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 5516. And at the top of the gavel, we will be adjourned.
Chairman, thank you for a great